topic tonight is guru groupies, or what sometimes people say guru groupies. Groupie is a word that's used in the rock and roll business. I don't know if it's used outside that, but for those who have a following and like to follow that particular band, or like bands have fan clubs, something like that. You understand, right? It's one who's attached to a particular group. That's their favorite group. They follow them. Maybe they have their pictures all over their house. They have every album, CD they've ever made, even anything that wasn't released, somehow they get it. They're always talking about them like that. So then you might say, well, is there anything wrong with doing that with your guru? And the answer is yes and no. You see, it depends on why you're doing it, and it depends on the result of what you're doing and how it's affecting other people. Because the challenge that we're having in our movement is a challenge of unity with Prabhupada's teachings and Prabhupada's desire in the center, right? Now, let's give a extreme case of guru groupism. Let's say your guru says something, and what he says is correct. But in it being correct, it perhaps hasn't fully addressed an issue or a siddhanta, and there are other aspects to that issue. Yes? Or siddhanta. It's not, addressed, let's say your guru addresses part of a topic, and he gives emphasis to a certain aspect or a certain set of shlokas. But what he's saying is absolutely correct, but he's not presenting the topic fully. And then perhaps another guru is presenting another aspect of that topic or another possible siddhanta. And then you, as a disciple, in your preaching, in your work, will also emphasize that one aspect, which is generally, we would say, okay, that's fine. But someone else may disagree or want to add a little more light to perhaps balance it out. And then you start arguing. No, my Guru Maharaj said this, therefore that's what it's like. And that's just how it is. And that's the philosophy. And basically, you don't really know what you're talking about because my guru is more learned, more advanced, more renounced. He has deeper philosophical understanding. Although you won't say that, you'll just think that. You understand? Yeah. Now, then you might say, but isn't it natural that one will think their guru is the best? Because that's why I chose him to be my guru, because I thought he was the best. Yeah. So, we've given the example before that every child thinks their mother, generally, if they have a nice mother, a nice father, they think, my father's the best. You are the best father. You are the best mother in the whole world, right? Isn't that what little kids say? You're the best father in the world. You are the best mother in the world. I love you. Is it objectively true that they're the best father and mother? No. But to that child, not only are they the best father and the mother, they're the only father and the mother. So they could be the best and worst at the same time because they're the only one. But it's natural, out of affection, that that's how they see, right? Which is healthy. It's actually not, it would be unhealthy, right? But if the result of them thinking that their mother and father is the best is that your mother and father is not the best, or your mother and father is bad, because my mother and father is the best, that means your mother and father could not be as good as my mother and father, then you have a problem. Right? You understand?
Yes.
Yeah. Right? So, simultaneously, your mother and father are the best, and your friend across the street, their mother and father are the best. And your friend's mother and father are the best. They're the best for each of your friends. But your mother and father is not the best for your friend across the street. Now, it may be that your mother and father adopts or becomes a foster parent or in some way takes care of your friend because their parents cannot do it for one reason or another, or their parents are violent or alcoholics or so on. Then you might say, your mother and father is the best because now they're taking care of me better than my mother and father. So that's a fact, but that's an abnormal case. And that's not really the issue, because if, for example, your guru is unable to perform his duties, then naturally you'll understand that and you will think, you know, he was good when he was good, but now he's not able to help me like he used to, so I'm getting help somewhere else. And the person who's helping me, now he's the best. That might happen. But that's just an exception. I'm speaking generally. So it is said in our philosophy of Krishna consciousness, there are some things which are achintya. Achintya means inconceivable. Some things are inconceivable. And it is said that Lord Shiva is inconceivable. Shiva Tattva. Is he Vishnu? Is he not Vishnu? Well, he's kind of Vishnu, but not exact. Then he becomes Gopishwar Mahadev. He becomes a Gopi in Vrindavan, protects the Dham. And Sadashiva is the eternal form, and Shiva in this world is a manifestation, which is not eternal. And on and on. And then it may be difficult to understand everything. Exactly. And it's not that we have to understand, it's just difficult. So it said that Shiva Tattva is achintya. Achintya means for us it's inconceivable. So, and then it said Guru Tattva, it's also inconceivable. And I had mentioned this point before, and I think at this point in the series I may mention some points that I mentioned earlier to remind you, and then also for the benefit of those who weren't in those classes. So it is also said Guru Tattva is inconceivable. It's achintya. And the reason it's said it's inconceivable is because it's very subjective. As I was saying, that the disciple will think my guru is the best. That's subjective. The problem is when the disciple thinks it's objective. Because if subjectively you think your guru is the best, it's because out of affection, out of the relationship, he is the best for you. You have the best relationship. But if you think objectively he's the best, then that becomes foundation for creating faction within our movement. That, well, if your guru is the best, that would logically mean, or logically it would follow, that why do we need other gurus? Or we have other gurus, but they should all represent him. And he should be guiding because he's the best. Yes? Yeah, so that, now, I think you understand the idea, objective and subjective. Subjectively, your guru is the best, but it's not an objective reality. That's why Guru Tattva is said to be inconceivable. Now, there's another point that I think I've made, which is quite interesting. Maybe it's a little controversial, but controversial means that we have to perhaps discuss it more deeply or look at a topic in a way perhaps it's not looked at normally. And let's say you take 10 different devotees and they're all initiating spiritual masters, or even for the sake of discussion, some are six-year gurus. And for the sake of discussion, You're trying to understand who is the best guru. And my contention is that even if you objectively say, this guru is the best because he's the most renounced, he's the most knowledgeable, he's the most compassionate, he's the most empowered. Let's say, for the sake of discussion. But does that necessarily mean that by taking shelter of him, it will be the best thing for your spiritual life because he's, quote unquote, better than the other gurus? And my contention is, no, not necessarily. Just like, is the best mother and father necessarily the one who has the best parenting skills? Not necessarily. But the best mother and father may be the ones who best understand the child and the ones who have the most affection. Just like, for example, you may be a better parent than I am, but I love my child more than you do. So I'm a better parent for my child because I love them more. Not because I have all the parenting skills that you have. No, you could extend that argument and say, well, if you're a really bad parent, then the other parent would be better. You could, but I'm saying here, all the parents are qualified, but some are much more qualified. But because your parents love you, then they're the best parents for you, because they'll always take care of you, right? They'll always show you affection. And your parents understand you. The other parents, they don't understand you. Your parents have raised you, so they know you really well. So, this is just my observation, that because the affection a guru has for a disciple, because of the compatibility that the guru has for the disciple, because for the mutual, what should we say, they're on the same frequency, it's a good relationship, that guru-disciple relationship becomes perfect. Even that guru may not be as advanced as the guru down the street. And so, for you it's perfect, just like your parents are perfect. Or your husband's perfect, but he's not the best husband in the world, but for you he's perfect. So, now, this point is interesting. And I'll explain why I think it's interesting. Because when Prabhupada left, when Prabhupada left us to continue the movement, and that meant some of us would have to take the role of guru at that time, and some of us would eventually have to take the role of guru at some point in the future. Now, one might think, just looking at the level of advancement of the devotees, one might think, none of Prabhupada's disciples are now qualified to accept disciples. They're young, and they're young in Krishna consciousness. And they're also young in their understanding of Krishna consciousness. And so therefore, it would seem logical or better either that Prabhupada not authorize them to initiate for 5 years or 10 years. And in retrospect, one might say, not even 10, 15 years. People weren't mature enough to initiate at least for 15 years. You could make that argument. Or many of them weren't. Or in general, it would have been better to wait. It would have been more successful. We would have had less people leaving and more advanced devotees. And, or you could say, because they weren't mature in Krishna consciousness, Prabhupada would have, or should have, or could have, or you would, I'm thinking logically here, Prabhupada would have appointed, or asked, not appointed, but asked his godbrothers to initiate until we were ready. Or he would have told us, I would like you, I don't think you're ready to take on disciples, I don't think you'll be ready until you're older, so for the next 10, 15 years, I request that you go either to this brother, this one, this one, this one, and take your diksha from them. But you stay in ISKCON and work together. He'd never said that. Now, I think last week we had mentioned that, some devotees had said that Prabhupada had given authorization to go to one or two of his godbrothers to learn more deeply the philosophy of Krishna consciousness. And I'm not contending that. Or Prabhupada had asked his godbrothers, take care of them, help them. Help them, yeah. Or, I don't think he said take care of them. He said help them. And Prabhupada did say, they're young. You know, I've done what I can, you help them. Right? So he did say that. And if you, and one devotee says that Prabhupada told him, if you, you know, I don't know the question that was asked, but he said, if you want to understand philosophy more deeply, you can go to my godbrother. But he never indicated that we were to take diksha there. Of course, you might say, well, if you go there and take siksha, naturally you would take diksha. But he never gave that order. The only order that we have, that we know of, in terms of who would give initiation, is his disciples, Prabhupada's own disciples. Now, my point is that looking at that situation objectively, they are not really qualified. And Prabhupada's godbrothers, from a Krishna conscious point of view, were qualified, much more qualified in Krishna consciousness. But were they more qualified to become our gurus and our diksha gurus? And my suggestion is not necessarily. That even though men were not very Krishna conscious, Prabhupada chose us as his group, that we were better suited. And why were we better suited? I think the obvious reason is because we were within ISKCON, and we would keep that unity. And the other obvious reason is that we were representing Prabhupada, and others were not representing Prabhupada's mood, and they weren't representing the mission of ISKCON. So that, when Prabhupada wanted us to stay within ISKCON, it wasn't because there weren't people who were not qualified as spiritual masters or as siksha gurus, as diksha or siksha gurus. But he wanted everything to stay within ISKCON. Now, I have another observation, and these are simply my observations. And so, because they're my observations, there may be people who disagree. But I also know that there are many people who agree. And it relates, again, to the subjective nature of guru-disciple relationship. And that is that I have personally associated, listened to, spent a little time with those gurus who devotees say that Prabhupada, not devotees say, but who Prabhupada asked, help ISKCON, help us. I've been with them. And I've seen that there's something that would happen to some of the people who went there, which was not healthy for them. Even though the katha was healthy, what they were getting was healthy, but the effect it had on those disciples was not healthy, as if it was an overdose. It was the right medicine, but it wasn't given in the right quantity, or it wasn't given on an empty stomach, or in some way the medicine was not received well by everyone. And I began thinking that even though the instructions were very powerful, that some people were not actually ready for those instructions, and what they were dealing with in their spiritual life was not being addressed by those particular gurus in a way which they needed at that time and place. Because many, many people who would go to here just needed some basic sadhana. They weren't even on that level of following regulative principles. And you know how in ISKCON we very much emphasize the four regulative principles in 16 rounds. Because Prabhupada emphasized it, we emphasize it. And we emphasize book distribution. because Prabhupada emphasized it, that anyone who's done book distribution knows how powerfully purifying it is and how it brings you so close to Prabhupada. So I noticed these things and I thought, even though the realizations and the katha that these devotees are hearing is probably or undeniably deeper and more realized than any ISKCON guru can give, for many of those people, it's not what they needed at that point in their spiritual life. And rather than them benefiting from it as they could if they were more advanced, it actually didn't address what they needed. And so that particular guru was not actually the best person for that disciple. And you could also say, if that particular guru is within an organization, then you also have to look at the organization, because the organization and the guru, they go together. It's like when you get married, you are admitted into another family. So it's not that you just marry a man or a wife. You marry a whole family, right? So the husband may be good, but the mother-in-law is driving you crazy. Or the mother-in-law may be good, but the husband's driving you crazy. Or the wife's driving you crazy. And this is quite common in India, where the husband's very good, but the mother-in-law or the father-in-law is driving them crazy. Or even their own mother or father is driving them crazy. So, does that make sense? It's a whole, you know, it's not, okay, he's a great husband, but he comes along with the package. So he's a great guru, but he comes along with the society, and that society may not be able to support you as you could be supported in the ISKCON society. So it's another consideration. So it's not downplaying the qualification of guru, but it comes along with the society, and you might need a society which is structured the way ISKCON is structured. Of course, some people will say, I don't need a society like that. That society's not good. But I'm speaking, that may be true in some cases, and I'm speaking from my personal realization, what I've seen of people who have had difficulty. Not everyone has difficulty, and this is not true for everyone. And I'm only making the point that for some people, my observation is that they needed a guru whose emphasis was very fundamental. Chant your rounds. Follow the regular principles. And then they may be criticized. Oh, after all these years, that's all he's teaching? You know, we're going very deeply into philosophy. We're going very deeply into Leela, and you're just teaching 16 rounds. But you will find in that Sangha where they're teaching very deeply, there may be many people who are not even chanting 16 rounds. So the other point that I've observed is that, let's say, your guru is very, very elevated, and objectively he's far more advanced, but he doesn't have time for you. So there may be a situation in where you take diksha from someone who's less advanced, who has more time for you, and the result will be better. You know, you could marry this man, he's a better husband, but he works 365 days a year for 18 hours, so you may never see him. So although he's a better husband, he can't really act as a husband for you. Whereas this other man, he's not as great a husband, but he'll be there for you. So these are just some considerations. I don't know how we got on this topic, but, oh yeah, we got on this topic of achinta, that how a disciple will see his guru as better. So in this way, a disciple may see that Guru X is better than Guru Z, although Guru X is more Krishna conscious, more advanced, he's been a devotee longer, he's more renounced, whatever. But Guru Z is better for this disciple because they understand one another, he can put his time and attention, they work well together, and Guru Z can really help this person, even though Guru X is more advanced. That makes sense? Okay, so that means when you say, my guru is the best guru, it means he's the best guru for you. It doesn't mean objectively he's the best guru, right? But he's definitely the best guru for you. Hopefully, you chose the guru who's best for you. But if you say that he's the best, it means simultaneously it's one and different. He's the best for you. But He may not be the best in the world, but he's definitely the best in the world for you. Now, why am I stressing this? I'm stressing this because if we think, no, he's the best, it's obvious, he's the best, he's the most advanced, he has the deepest realizations, he understands Siddhanta better than anyone, he's been a devotee longer, maybe he was the first in ISKCON, or maybe he was even a devotee before we were born, he's a senior, or before we were devotees. Maybe he was raised in a Vaishnava family, and he knows Shastra better than anyone, so on and so forth. If we come to the point where we start creating factions, that this guru is the guru, he's the one, he's the effulgent, self-effulgent Acharya, ISKCON doesn't recognize him, he should be recognized, you can take it to extremes, he should be controlling the GBC and so on. Then we have huge problems. And that was, of course, if you know the history, that was the problem that the Gaudiya Math had. That they were trying to argue over who was the next in line. And the next in line meant who was the most qualified or most advanced or who was that Acharya who would, so to speak, replace Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, you can't replace him, but who would take over, which in a sense means you're taking the position as the most elevated devotee within a Gaudiya Math, the one who's qualified to lead the Gaudiya Math. Right. Of course, we could say if there was anybody, it was Prabhupada. But the point is, Prabhupada was never thinking that I want to take over the Gaudiya Math. He was only thinking, I want the Gaudiya with my preaching. Right? And now we'll look at it and say, look, he did fulfill Bhaktisiddhanta's desire, and so he really understood Bhaktisiddhanta's heart, so he was the self-effulgent Acharya most qualified. And Prabhupada never thought that way, which is very instructive. And he didn't think that way because he understood that the factioning was destroying the Gaudiya Math, and that's not what Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur wanted. Right? So, we were talking a few weeks ago that in the future of ISKCON, now there's I don't know how many gurus there are, initiating gurus, maybe 100 or something. Last night, I met a devotee, and he said, why don't you become a guru? You'll have people that would want to take diksha from you. And I said, I am a guru. And he said, oh, I didn't know. He said, I went online and your name wasn't on the list. So then I Googled ISKCON gurus and I couldn't find a list anywhere except on one site, which was not as far as I can tell, it definitely wasn't a GBC site. And it was quite an outdated list and it also had, it was very outdated because it had people from other institutions on the list. But it did say it was supposed to be a list of ISKCON gurus. Anyway, so that was a side point. I don't know how many there are because there's no list. But I've heard there's something like 100. And now devotees are looking to the future. If the movement continues to expand at the rate it's expanding, then and the guru... the position of guru becomes more of a local teacher, then we'll need, rather than one having thousands and thousands of disciples, but more gurus, more local, smaller numbers, then let's say now a guru has 2,000 disciples, that's one guru with 2,000, then we'd want to say 20 gurus, we'll need 20 gurus, each with 100, something like that, right? So then, if you add up all the disciples we have in ISKCON, let's say maybe there's 80,000 disciples or something, initiated devotees, and there's 100 gurus, so then if you divide that by 100, 80,000 by 100, what do you get? 800? 800 gurus? Or 8,000? No. You get 800, I think. Is that right? Who's got a calculator? So let's say you, instead of 100 gurus, we'd have 800. and then multiply that by the increased number of disciples, then there's talk of, well, in the future we'll have 1,000, 2,000 gurus. You know, it'll be teachers. You'll have hundreds of thousands of devotees, so you'll need thousands of gurus. But each, 100,000 devotees and 1,000 gurus. 200,000, 300,000, 3,000 gurus. Each with 100, let's say. You know, like in a classroom, you have private schools, classrooms are small, 20, 30, 40. You get a classroom, 150, 200, 300, 400. Professor, he can't interact well with everyone. So then the question is, are we going to have 1,000 movements when we have 1,000 gurus? Are we going to have 3,000 movements when we have 3,000 gurus? So that's a consideration. I've seen personally that in certain cultures there's a certain mentality which tends towards that way of thinking, that the guru is a very regional thing, that it's like you have your family and you're not really part of a bigger family. You want to keep your family distinct or separate. So when disciples are thinking our guru is the best, he's the only one, it plants the seeds for this kind of separation. Now, it also could be, in some cases, a combination of guru and disciple, where a guru is not aware enough of how his disciples are thinking, and he's not directing them to think in a more universal way. It's ISKCON, it's Prabhupada, and we're all together, unified under that banner. And although you're my disciples or you're the disciples of this other one, our common bond is as sons and daughters or grandsons and granddaughters of Prabhupada, and we don't have individual movements going on separately that have their own nature almost existing in a sense, one and different than ISKCON. And that multiplied that by 100, by 500, by 1,000, and then it will be very difficult for ISKCON to be unified. And one of the things that concerns me is that Madhava Preeti is blessing us. Maybe 1,000 years from now, you and other Srila Prabhupada disciples will come back to guide ISKCON to make sure it's still going on without major deviations. Okay, Madhava Preeti. Or Krishna will arrange it ultimately, but we're at this point, we're trying to create a foundation in which we can do something which traditionally has never been done, an organization in which there are many different gurus, but they're all existing simultaneously in a unified way. Whereas if you're one guru in one ashram in one organization, then this discussion isn't even necessary because there are no other gurus. It's only you. And so you don't have to coordinate with anybody else. It's just you. It's easy, right? It's your guru and you. And your God brothers and the God sisters. That's pretty easy, right? And it's just kind of normal. But in order for this to work, then we make some adjustments to align with Srila Prabhupada's desire for unified movement. So then the adjustment is, how can you take the position of guru, which is so absolute that he is as good as God, and that whatever he says should be followed absolutely, and at the same time coordinate that within a broader organization in which you have many authorities, such as temple presidents, TBCs, or just Namhata leaders, or temple commanders, or Sankirtan leaders. You'll have so many authorities. And how do you work that in, along with the fact that other gurus and other sannyasis will come and give classes, and you'll hear from them and hear all other instructions? So, extremely important. Many devotees realize this, or they will realize this as they stay in Krishna consciousness, is that it's an achinta beda beda tattva, where everything is working simultaneously, one and different. So simultaneously, there's a oneness of all instructions in as much as they were trying to represent Prabhupada. And we're trying to keep ISKCON unified. So and then the question will come up, well, how do I deal with different instructions that I hear? Because some instructions sometimes appear contradictory to one another. You know, one, just like we were giving a Grihastha seminar, and I was saying that sometimes it's not wise to be tolerant in a situation in which a person is not qualified to be a husband or a wife. They're misusing their position. And just like Shastra says, you should serve your wife. Shastra says you should serve your husband. Wife should be submissive, humble, and so forth. But there's a point at which a husband takes advantage of that. And rather than acting as a husband, he's demanding submission, but he's not taking on the function of a husband. And it becomes problematic for the marriage, or it becomes a problem for the wife, I'd say unhealthy. And then that she's not obligated to follow the husband, just as one who has a guru who's fallen by order of Shastra is not obligated to follow a fallen guru. Now, one could argue, no, he's your guru. A disciple should always be submissive to the guru. And that's true, but the guru has to be a guru. So it's not any guru, it's a qualified, bona fide guru, right? So Prabhupada always talks about the bona fide guru. So you submit to a bona fide guru. Submit to anyone. And if your guru, if you've submitted to your guru, and later on he deviates, or he becomes helplessly fallen, or tells you not to surrender to Prabhupada, then by shastric injunction and the instructions of other acharyas, it's your actually duty to not follow him. It would be wrong to follow him. So I was making that point because sometimes in some situations a woman is put in an environment where her husband is not any longer acting properly as a husband, but she's instructed, no, you should follow him, you should be submissive because that's your stri dharma, that's your duty as a woman. And I was saying that instruction that you should follow your husband is correct. We can't argue with that. That you should be submissive and so forth. That's normal. That's natural. But not when he's not qualified, because it may empower him to mistreat you. And it's not healthy for you, it's not healthy for him. Just as if you honor and worship a guru who's fallen, then it makes his situation even worse, because he thinks he can get away with anything. And my disciples, they have to follow me no matter what. And I could even exploit my disciples. Yes? Because they're going to follow me. They'll do whatever I say. Okay. Go rob a bank. Bring me money. Yes, Guru Maharaj. Right? And so forth. So then devotee said, well, they had just attended a class in which they had heard that no matter what, the wife should be submissive, and in fact the wife should think that I'm somewhat responsible for my husband's behavior, because if I was a better wife, then he wouldn't be mistreating me. Now, in some cases, that may be true. I agree that sometimes wives do bring out the worst in their husbands. But in some cases, the husband is just not qualified or very troubled in his personal life. He's a troubled person, or he's very weak in his Krishna consciousness, and he's not really qualified to, at least at that point, act properly as a husband. So I said, if that's the case, then Prabhupada said a wife is not obliged to serve a husband who's fallen, just as the disciple is not obliged to serve a guru who's fallen. So it was another point of view. Right? So now we have two points of view. that are being spoken by leaders in ISKCON. And as you could imagine, this could be grounds for some kind of unpleasant amongst followers of those different people. And so I think the word here is achinta veda veda tattva, and also the word is mature. We have to be able to understand how various teachings apply in various situations. Now, for example, in understanding how not create factions and at the same time remain inspired and dedicated to what you're hearing from your guru and your Sikhu gurus that's inspiring you and making sense to you. So we have a contingent of devotees now who very much want to institute a more traditional Vedic culture within ISKCON, based around Daivi Varnashram. And so within Daivi Varnashram, a lot of the wives, and which have traditionally been followed in India, they're suggesting we should continue to follow. And a lot of those roles we're not following. Wow. We have a Tulsi garland here. My God. Now Tulsi's all over the floor, everywhere. I've never worn a Tulsi garland. Is it actually bona fide? Can we wear it? Is it okay? Or you know?
No, but I think... I don't know. You can use
it. I'll put it on my head.
Yeah, please. Bring to you.
I'll wear it on my head. And now everyone here is going to be laughing while I'm talking because I'll look like Cleopatra. Right? See? Now they're laughing. All right. My crown. I'm wearing a crown of Tulsi. Yeah. Now maybe Tulsi will make me speak something different. So there's a contingent of devotees who very much want to establish traditional Varnashram. And who can argue with that, because it's Prabhupada's desire. But when we're not living in a traditional environment, there are limitations in practically applying that. And one of the things that we're running into is because we don't have Varnashram well established in our movement, then, as you know, women are being educated like men. And they do many of the same things men do. But the education's the same, and they play many of the same sports, same instruments. Their life in many ways is very similar. Although men are different, but their lives are very similar, so their aspirations are similar. And so then people who are wanting to establish the more Vedic standard will say things are the way women are living today is not good. It's bad. So, and that's true in many cases, but in many cases it's practical and they have to live that way. Or they prefer to live that way. Let me see what Tulsi makes me say. I'm wearing Tulsi on my head and I'm waiting to channel something. Information. And so the point is valid. I think both points are valid. You're living in society and you're raised a certain way and you have certain ambitions because of how you're raised and your education. And then you use those skills and talents in Krishna service. So you're living in the city and say, you know, I work as a journalist, I work as a teacher, I work in television, this and that. And I try to use that, my skills, and spread Krishna consciousness. And they'll say, no, you shouldn't do that. You should be a stay-home mother. And you might say, but I don't, that was never how I was trained or raised. So you have both things going on. So you could make arguments for both, and you could quote Prabhupada, both. And even if both parties recognize that the traditional ultimately would be better, still we have to recognize the practicalities of the situation, and so that way we can respect one another. And so the problem comes is when we argue our point in a way to smash and bury the other point, to invalidate the other side. And then, of course, we use Shastra and Prabhupada, and it becomes very unhealthy for us. Are you going to clean up afterwards?
Yeah.
It becomes very unhealthy for us. And that's what I call maturity. And we all need to become mature. We all need to help other devotees become mature. And it doesn't mean that it minimizes your affection for your guru. And it doesn't mean it minimizes the faith you have in what your guru is teaching. But it also means that you are mature and broad enough to understand that Krishna consciousness is multidimensional. And there are many, many things you may not understand about it that others understand. And for us to coexist as one big happy family, we have to see that each senior devotee, maybe you could even say each devotee, is that everyone makes a contribution. And every contribution is valuable. But the contributions may be different. And difference means variety, and variety creates, you know, if everything's just the same, it's not interesting. So variety, so our movement is interesting because of the variety. That some devotees stress book distribution, some stress building Mayapur, some stress deity worship, some stress Varnashram, that everybody's contributing in a particular way. And rather than say, well, Varnashram's not good because my guru stresses book distribution. So I'm not into Varnashram. I don't think it's really what Prabhupada wanted. That's an immature understanding. And in a sense, that's offensive to those who are trying to spread Varnashram. Because in a sense, you're minimizing that by saying, you know, well, no, it's book distribution. My guru said book. This is just book distribution, right? That's what you call narrow-minded, black and white thinking, fanaticism. So obviously, if you want to distribute books, you need a little fanaticism. You have to be at least inspired that this is important. But Prabhupada always taught us that when you think one thing's important, it doesn't negate something else. That in the spiritual realm, many things can be the most important. And if you read Prabhupada's letters, you will find that if you go on Vedabase and Google most important, you'll find that Prabhupada said different things at different times were the most important. This is our most important. Raising children is the most important. Bhaktivedanta Institute, scientific preaching is the most important. Book distribution is the most important. College preaching is the most important. And he gave reasons why they're each most important. Because college preaching, you will get leaders. You'll get an intelligent class. And book distribution, it's the basis. It's our movement will spread because of book distribution. And scientific preaching will destroy the atheism of the world. And the most important is Gurukul, raising our children, because they're the future generation. So now you have most importance. And for most important, there's probably more. And this makes my point, that simultaneously things can be most important or different. You're a Gurukul teacher, and in your mind, this is the most important service. But if you're mature, it's most important for you, but it's not the most important thing for everybody. Then sometimes you'll find devotees and say, Why aren't people into Gurukul? Prabhupada said it's the most important, and then you get frustrated. Or why isn't this temple into book distribution? Prabhupada said this is the most important. We see that, isn't it? Very common. Or you feel that as an individual. And that's very unhealthy. And it's very immature, and it's very narrow, it's a very narrow way of thinking. So if we can appreciate another person's point of view and appreciate our service and appreciate our guru and appreciate another person's guru and appreciate that you might look at this guru and say, for me, I don't get so inspired, but I can understand why these other devotees are inspired. Right? Then, and for me, my guru is the best, And I know for you, your guru is the best. And but we're all united under Prabhupada, and that's what keeps us together. Then we have oneness and difference, but it's unified. That's why Prabhupada said unity and diversity. So it requires the ability to be open-minded enough to appreciate something that is not natural for you to appreciate. Maybe you don't appreciate farming. You appreciate preaching in a big city. That's what stimulates you. You think about it. I think about being on television and preaching to millions of people. And you're looking at these devotees talking about farming, you're thinking, you're just growing tomatoes, but I'm growing bhaktas. I don't understand. You know, I don't understand this, right? And the point is, you don't understand it. That's why you think that way. That's exactly why you think that way. It's completely true. You don't understand it. And so you need to take time to understand, what is Prabhupada's vision on this? Why are they doing this? Why are they fired up about it? Why do they think their guru is so great? Because he's one of the few who's thinking about Varnashram and how important it is for Prabhupada. And then you start to understand, oh, now I see, this really, we need this Varnashram because we're preaching in the city and we have no example of how to live. And our devotees' lives in the city is very compromised. They're working very hard. Oh, now I understand. Oh, it goes together with preaching in the city. We need both. And then now there's unity in diversity. Now there's achinta bheda bheda tattva. It's one and different simultaneously. Yeah, it's a very different service, but it's oneness in the overall plan, right? So many of us are handicapped in understanding other people's points of view that we don't share. So that's a challenge for many of us, but that challenge is necessary. We have to overcome that. So if you don't understand, you don't agree, try to understand. Agree, although my guru never said that. But what I found in my experience is that even if you disagree with something, even if your guru didn't say that, there's a thread of truth within it that your guru must have touched, or there's a thread of truth in it that he would agree with. He may not agree with the emphasis they put on it, because he may feel it's not a balanced approach if it's emphasized to the extent that it minimizes something else that's important. But at least you try to understand it in terms of what's the value there, what's the point, what are they, you know. So you'll see there's so many different kinds of preaching, you know. Now here, there's a book out, it's called Women as Mothers. And the book is promoting that women's role as mothers, grandmothers, aunts, stay at home. You know, sewing, cooking, churning butter, and so forth. And so you may look at that and go, you know, what's that all about, right? The initial reaction. But a mature reaction is, okay, what's being said here? Let's look, let's try to understand. What's the point here? Right? And you read the book and say, well, the point is that it's natural for women to be mothers, children, like that. And so, you know, you can't really argue with that. And that all the research shows that women are happier doing that than they are working in corporations. But you, at the same time, young women in ISKCON, they join, they're put out on Sankirtan, they're preaching, they're injected with this preaching spirit to go out and spread Krishna consciousness. They're not thinking about getting married, they're still young. And so those points may not yet register to the point where they want to settle down. So many young women tell me, I don't think about marriage. You know, Indian women think about getting married young, because that's the culture. Western women, you know, every one of, you know, half their parents' friends are divorced, half their friends already got divorced, they don't think about marriage. So you have, you know, so if we understand the context of what's being said, then we can appreciate within a certain context, yes, this is absolutely true. Women in the workplace are stressed out like anything. And then they go home and they have to maintain their families. Women aren't meant to work two jobs. So you understand what the point he's saying, that we have to go back to a more natural system and women will be happier and then let the men do their roles so the women can do their roles. So all right, he's making that point. So you say, yeah, that's a good point. I accept, I understand it. But right now you're engaged, you're on television and you're doing a television show and you've got like 10,000 people watching you, and you're not thinking about being a stay-at-home mother because you made like 1,000 devotees last year. And you know Prabhupada would be pleased with that, even though you're a woman, right? And even though you don't have kids and you're 30 years old, and people are saying you should have kids now. So you know, you balance it, so you understand, yeah, that's true. At some point I'm going to, you know I have this other side and I have to cater to it. And what being said in this book is true. But right now, this is happening and my guru is encouraging me and so forth. So there's a balance there. And then if we learn to be more balanced as individuals, then we avoid guru-groupism. That we understand and appreciate the value of everyone's contribution, everyone's angle on Krishna consciousness. And we think, yes, your guru is the best in this area. Your guru is the best in this area. Your guru is the best in this area. Oh, your guru, he gives such nice classes on Varnashram. Yeah, he's just amazing. He understands it so well. He's so good at it. Yes, so we need all the best. So it's good. Everyone, in Krishna consciousness, you can have many bests. That's transcendental. So it requires a broader understanding of the philosophy. If your understanding is very narrow, you'll tend to be I'm right, you're wrong. If you have a nature where you can't listen, you just turn off. My guru never said that. And immediately your mind just turns off, right? So now you can't listen to anything. And studies in psychology tell us that if your mind turns off, even if you're given facts, it won't make sense to you. You'll just say no. Say, no, but Prabhu, this is the research, this is the facts, it's like this. No, my guru said this. And so you're not, you know, and then you tell your guru, tell his guru, yeah, that's true, that research is like that, and it means this, it means that. The disciple didn't even understand what the guru meant, because the guru is not as narrow-minded as the disciple. Rinai Nanaraj made a historical point. He said that if you study religious history, you will find that the disciples of the great reformers like Buddha, incarnations, Lord Jesus, Muhammad, the disciples are all way more fanatic than the gurus themselves. He said, that's history. You know, they're much more fanatic. You know, the Christians became fanatical and they went on their crusades. They had their own jihad. They said, the Buddhists became more austere than Lord Buddha. And Lord Buddha, he taught about the middle path. Renunciation, but living in the world and practical. And he said, and they, you know, developed this whole tradition of monasteries, and to be Buddhist, you had to be a monk. And so they became more austere, more fanatical than Buddha. And we see that with some devotees in ISKCON also, or out in Gaudiya Math, and more fanatical than Prabhupada. Mm. So there's that tendency there, right? And that is the tendency that creates guru-groupism. You know, you become fanatical about your guru. He's better, he's the one. And then it sets the stage or plants the seed for factions. And if there's anything that could ruin ISKCON, it's going to be factions. So it requires a lot of maturity on the part of devotees to overcome their tendency to not be able to listen to various points of view that they don't believe they agree with, or initially they don't seem to agree with, and to be able to appreciate other people who have those points of view and appreciate what's good about it. Maybe it doesn't make sense for you in your personal life, but at least appreciate it within the context of the person's teaching it, how it will make sense to people within that context, right? And you're working, you're living in the city, you have a mortgage, you have so many aspirations, that's just who you are. So within that context, this particular service or way of thinking makes sense. It works for you. It helps you in your Krishna consciousness. Ideally, maybe it's not the best. Maybe ideally, it should be different. You shouldn't be living in the city. And you can even admit that and say, yeah, I know. Ideally, I shouldn't, but I have these desires and I have to process it and I have to deal with them. So your approach is, it takes in consideration as many perspectives as possible. Then we have another example that's given by our acharyas. And Prabhupada addresses it in the Bhagavatam, that sometimes we'll see even great acharyas have different views on the same philosophical point. And so we are recommended that we should never take sides. We should see that both simultaneously they're correct, although they seem different. And it's transcendental. So it can be correct on a transcendental level. But that we should never take sides, because if you take sides, then it becomes sort of an apparat to the other side. So, you know, we may not agree, we may think this perspective is not correct, it's fanatical, or it's destructive, or whatever, but it's better not to take sides in an argument. You know. Now, this is very, very difficult when your guru is being attacked by someone, not to take sides. Right? So, you know, probably, that when something is wrong and you stand against it, often you become more wrong by the way you stand against it. Not, I'm not saying that if something's wrong, we don't stand against it always. But what I'm saying is sometimes something is wrong because someone is very vocal about the mistakes of another person, and then you become even more vocal about their mistake of pointing out the mistake of the other person. So you're doing exactly what they're doing, and you don't realize it. But you're even doing it worse than they're doing it, right? So that's why it's important not to to be careful that you don't make the same mistake someone else makes. And so, okay, your guru is being criticized by somebody else for something he said, and now you're very angry, and you want to criticize that person who criticized your guru. And so now what happens? Now we have a big, you know, now we have sides. You're on the side of your guru, and he's on the side of his guru, right? Now you have a third problem, which is even worse. You're not on the side of your guru. You agree with the other one. Then it gets even more complicated, doesn't it? You know, the person who's criticizing your guru is like, actually, I think his point is better than my guru's point. Now what do you do? You see, so the whole thing becomes, can become quite messy, right? Yeah. So if we say, no, they're both right, it's transcendental. And in the transcendental realm, there's definitely room for many, many opinions, right? So now, Krishna Kirtan says, I said something about various, I think she's replying to my statement, I said, you know, you have various authorities within ISKCON. And in a traditional society, you don't have various authorities. You have your guru, or authorities that are directly working with your guru. Like, let's say your guru's, he has an ashram, you're in the ashram, he's overseeing it. So everyone is working with him. It's kind of easy. You see the unity there. But as ISKCON is practically, your guru is in one place, you're in another place, your authorities are different. Some of you may be working more closely with your guru, so his authority is more pervasive. But in general, for many, many devotees, probably most devotees, they're not working in temples necessarily supervised under the authority of their guru. And so, Shastra says, you know, your guru is absolute, whatever he says. You should do it. He's representing God. So we say that's true in terms of him giving the teachings of Krishna. That's true. But in terms of managerial authority, you will have other authorities. And your guru, in order to cooperate with the management in ISKCON, his authority is not meant to supersede the authority of local management. So you have simultaneously, you have authorities. Managerially, Prabhupada wanted everyone to follow their temple president. So whatever, he's your authority, do what he says. So you have that level of authority. Then you have the spiritual authority of your spiritual master. And you may have the spiritual authority of local devotees. So you have various forms of authority within ISKCON, and we're meant to enable them to work well together. Now, if you're, let's say, temple president is asking you to do something, your guru wants you to do something else, or it's a philosophical misunderstanding, then you have a discussion, or you go to your guru and you explain your dilemma, or you go to your temple president and explain your dilemma, and then you sort it out. And my, I think my mantra is the word maturity, and I am defining here maturity as a tolerance of other points of view, and an ability or a desire to understand other points of view, to be open to them, even if you don't find them useful for yourself, or even if you don't understand them, or don't necessarily agree with them, but be open to understand why someone else would agree, and an ability to be unified, to work together, even though we may have various points of view, different angles of vision, and to see the validity of all those points. Look, sometimes someone may make a point in a class and say, I don't really agree with that point, but then try to understand within a certain context how that point has its validity. A lot of times you'll understand that the person who's saying that, relating what they're saying to a particular context. So within the context of their experience, it makes sense. He might say, how it's so nice that women do this, that, and that. And he sees how it works in the villages. There's no divorce. Women are happy, this and that. So then he gives a talk and says, you know, woman's place is really in the home, taking care of the kids, making, churning the butter, sewing, cooking. And all these, you know, 22-year-old women who have just come from the West are listening to this lecture. This doesn't make sense. Talking about, you know, we have to preach, spread Krishna consciousness. How can I spread Krishna consciousness if I'm churning butter? Wouldn't it be better I just buy butter? You know, then I can go on book distribution, but if I churn butter, it's like, you know, I can't go out. So whenever you don't agree with something, then you want to try to understand, well, what's the context from which this person is presenting? What's his context? And what's the context of his, you know, philosophically and practically, what's the context of his life and situation? Right? You understand? Yeah. And that's why sometimes people will say things and you'll hear it and say, that doesn't make any sense. That's the craziest thing I ever heard. But when you understand the context, then you realize, well, within that context, it makes sense. You know? And I see that particularly the Western and the Indian way of thinking of the same thing often is the complete opposite difference. And it's very frustrating for either side to see how the other are thinking. I say, why are they thinking this is so bad the way they're thinking? And then the Indians thinking it's so bad the way the Westerners are thinking. You know? So but it's within a context. But if you explain the context of it and say, well, you know, this is why we think this way, because our culture is based on respect for elders, and this is why we're so obedient to our parents and so forth, why we take care of them and do that. Okay, that makes sense, right? Respect to elders, that's perfect, right? And then you come in from the Western point of view and say, but your elder doesn't know what they're saying right now, and they're telling you things that are destroying your family right now. You agree with that? And they'll say, yeah, that's true. Say, and so do you see why we see the fault in that system? We don't see the fault in the system in general, but we see how it's misapplied, and that's why we're so upset that you're following what your parents are telling you to do because it's destructive to you. And they'll say, yes, then they'll say, yes, I understand that, I feel that, but our culture is the fault. Okay, so let's create some balance. How can we follow and not follow? How can we stand up for what we believe and still be respectful? You know, so then that's maturity, right? So we want to be able to see both here. Does that make sense? Yes.
What if you are talking with someone that this devotee completely says something wrong about Shastra and he's really sure that this is, you know...
You mean he's saying something that's not in Shastra or he's misunderstanding it?
Misunderstanding completely. Uh-huh. But this devotee is completely sure that what she's saying is right. Is it true?
And I want to say, I understand what you're saying, but so-and-so Maharaj has explained it differently. I heard class last week and it was explained this way, so maybe that is another understanding that we can consider and say, oh yeah. Or you don't say anything. Or just say, that's okay. Not everybody understands it that way. I understand what you're saying, but I've heard other very senior devotees explain it differently. That you know, Krishna consciousness is very broad. You can understand things from different perspectives. Or you can say, yes, what you're saying is true. And also, we can understand it this way as well. Instead of but, it's like this. We say, and also, there's another way of understanding that. You see, anything which is going to create division in our movement or divide us in any way is not pleasing to Prabhupada, because Prabhupada stressed unity and diversity. And so when we had the meetings a few weeks ago, a very nice point was made. It said, you don't have to try for diversity. It's always there. You have to try for unity. So naturally, one person's going to say, this is what Shastra says, because that's how they understand it. I can guarantee you 30 years from now, they'll understand it better than they do now. So we really have to work on the unity. So that's something we have to try for. And we really have to try for it. And so, you know, like I'm making the point, let's say you disagree with this person, and the result of that disagreement is it just divides you. The mic fell away. Oh, no. So should I repeat what I just said because you didn't hear it? Yeah, my mic fell off. And we were talking about me, and we were saying that sometimes something doesn't make sense to you, but you have to understand it within the context of the person speaking, how it will make sense to them because of where they're coming from. Just like if you were born 50 years ago, things are going to make sense to you that don't make sense to people born today. So who's right? You're both right. But it's just the context. You're emphasizing a certain aspect of it because of the context. So Anuradha was saying, well, what if somebody's really convinced they're right and you think they're wrong? How do you deal with it? And I said, you understand the context, that what's right for one is wrong for another. And sometimes, like a great class, someone hates it. And it's a really bad class, someone loves, because their lives are in different positions and there's different context. So that's basically what we said. And in the recording, I'll go to that point and I'll raise the level. I'll find that. Sorry. The mic dropped off my shirt. Wasn't on properly. So now we're going to read a controversial question. Keep all of you attention. Keep your attention focused. I'll raise another controversial point if you allow me to do so. I understood you supported the point GBC was high spiritual authority. Well, managerial. How do you explain they have only put their photos and profiles on GBC website as if they were the only gurus in ISKCON and not mentioned anywhere about the 80 gurus or so? With their photos and profiles on top managerial authority website, ISKCON. I could explain what I think, but it's not based on talking to them, because I was on their website last night and I thought the same thing. I thought, what if someone wants to find a guru in ISKCON? You can't go anywhere to find out about the gurus, or if you can. I went to Desire Tree, I thought maybe it's there, but I didn't find it there. A year ago or so, I thought I found it. You know, it had different gurus. You find them on the Ritvik site. You know, all the bad things about gurus and their pictures and their profiles. That's where you find it, unfortunately. So I was thinking, why? And I think the two is because they, you know, people don't know who the GBC is and what they do. So number one, they just, you know, want people to know. This is the GBC that runs ISKCON. These are the devotees. This is a little bit about their history. Just so, you know, it's kind of like you're in a company, and you know, who's running the company, that kind of thing. I don't think it was anything more than that. And the reason I think, and this is just me, why they don't have a list of gurus and their pictures and this and that is they want to get away from the concept that these gurus are authorized ISKCON gurus, and that people who aren't authorized by them are not gurus, or potentially you could choose any Prabhupada disciple as your guru, at this point in the male body. And they want to steer away from that idea that we have authorized these people. If you want a guru, here's the list, go pick someone off this list. Rather, they want you to find a qualified guru who may not even be on the list, and that guru would just go through a system and could get approved to initiate you. That's my sense of why they don't want to do it, because they don't want to say, here are the 100. Pick from this list. But they want to say, find someone who's qualified and take shelter of them. And then ask them for initiation. And then see what happens, if they can actually give you, if they're in a position to give you initiation. If their guru has authorized it or their guru has left, and they're qualified and they want to do it, they're inspired to do it. So I think that's my... So I don't actually think it's that controversial. I think it's just practical. That's my understanding. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense why they wouldn't have gurus, because naturally, you have new people say, I want a guru, how do I find one? And then you would think ISKCON would say, well, here are the names and emails and the websites of all the existing gurus. Go and find. Go look at their website. And that's what a lot of people do. Someone wrote me and said, well, I was... you know, thinking of joining ISKCON, and I went through all the websites, and I liked your website, so I'm writing you. So you think that's natural. But maybe there's no place where you can do that, which doesn't seem right. So I wrote to somebody last night, and just telling them that when you Google ISKCON Guru List or ISKCON Gurus, you get all Ritvik stuff. ISKCON Bogus Gurus, ISKCON Fall Down Gurus, this, that. That's what you get. You know, you don't get a list of gurus in ISKCON. I think it would be a good idea to do that. And then people can, you know, new people can go to different websites, hear different lectures. So Krishna Kirtan says, maturity means to have the ability to reconcile or accept different viewpoints and keep unity and diversity in Srila Prabhupada's movement. Is that the main point you were stressing? Yeah. Read that again. Maturity means to have the ability to reconcile or accept different viewpoints and keep unity in diversity. Yeah. Or just say, and keep unity, because you already mentioned the diversity. Reconcile or accept different viewpoints and keep unity. It's Srila Prabhupada's movement. That's a nice statement. That's the sum and substance. Yeah. And when we lack maturity, then it's all about my guru is better than your guru. He's right. This is right. That's wrong. Then we oppose one another, and then we have the potential to have huge factions, especially if one particular guru is very, very, very elevated. Then it's natural that everyone will think he's the one, and that's why I made the point that he may be the one, but he could also be the one to destroy ISKCON. If enough people keep saying he's the one, then that's what happened in Gaudiya Math. That's how it got destroyed. He's the one. Then somebody said, no, he's not the one. Then it fractioned in half. And they went to court, which one is the one? And then so many of the senior devotees were disillusioned by this fighting. They just went off, started their own temples. And so then that initial split then split it up into many factions. Because out of disgust, they all just wanted their own temples, didn't want to deal with it. Even Prabhupada, he helped open a temple just to have a place to preach and do something, because the movement had fractioned and fractioned. That's the history. You know that history?
Yes.
Yeah, we've talked a little bit about it. And so then... So Krishna Kirtan says that would be a good reason if they're gurus in ISKCON. But the difficulty in not authorizing gurus is that there is not a system now where you could really objectively, wholeheartedly say that they're not being authorized. But the GBC doesn't want to give the doesn't want devotees to think that the gurus that we have quote unquote authorized are actually authorized by us. So it's a really sensitive issue, because it's hard to say they're not authorized when they're going through a process to get approved. But what they're saying is, as far as we can tell, they're good devotees, and that's all we're saying. You know, we don't see that. There's any reason. We don't see any external factors that they can't give Krishna consciousness. And we see that they're following it, that they understand it and they practice it. But we're not saying necessarily that means they're a guru. That you have to decide. That's what they're trying to say. But in saying that, at least they've brought these people onto some position where we're saying it's okay to approach them for initiation. So it's hard to say we didn't authorize them. You know, that's the problem. Even though that's what they're saying, that it's hard to say that for the general devotees, because the devotees will say, are you an ISKCON guru? That's just, you know, there's ISKCON gurus, and there are ISKCON Diksha gurus, and there are Siksha gurus, who are bona fide Diksha gurus. So it's that's the challenge we have. And if in the future a system becomes where you, let's say, the GBC, for example, didn't do this anymore, there was no system, it was just, you are open to approach anybody. And then at that time, when you're approached, the person who's approached, if they want to take initiation, they have to, if they want to be able to give initiation, they have to let the GBC know, and the GBC will give them a mentor who works with them, and then when the mentor feels satisfied, he'll say, okay, go. And they just went through a mentorship, and there was nothing, you know, and if there is a problem, the mentor will work with him until he feels he's qualified, or convince him that he's not qualified. And then that devotee will say, well, I don't think I'm ready to initiate, I'm not going to do it. Or at a certain point he'll tell his followers, now, at this point, my mentor has blessed me, and I'm going to initiate. That system like that would be a little easier, because then you don't have a list of 100 authorized people. It's just anybody, any Prabhupada disciple, or anyone who is a disciple of a guru who's left. You can approach them. So, yeah. Urmila says, if all the Siksha disciples of Urmila can't get their initiation, their Harinam Diksha from her, that means the GBC think they're more qualified spiritually than her, doesn't it? My general answer, and this is just my personal opinion for whatever it's worth, is that the system is still awkward, and unless the system becomes more natural, where, as I said, someone approaches someone for diksha because that person has already been their Siksha guru, if it doesn't work that way, I think you're always going to have these kinds of issues. Now, someone may argue it needs to work the way it works for various reasons to protect the situation. It may not be true. That's another issue. But all I'm saying, as long as you have this system, then it's going to appear, it's going to be complicated. So I don't think the GBC feel particularly they're more spiritually qualified than her, but the way the system works may make it seem that way. That's my personal opinion. Until it comes to the point where it's just somebody is choosing their guru because they're inspired by that person, and that person therefore is required to do a mentorship program before they give diksha to understand through the experience of other diksha gurus how to do that, and then for the diksha guru to make sure that he feels comfortable that this person is now ready, and it's not an authorization, it's just a working together, and then they do it. That natural system then, I think, would alleviate a lot of these problems. I mean, that's my suggestion. Anyway, that's my personal suggestion, which I suggested to a committee that's dealing with this issue. I don't know. It's a departure from the present system. I find the present system has these problems that you present. Dustin says, besides the fact that he was our beloved founder Char and spotless pure devotee, what is the practical thing we can take and apply within our preaching? Practical thing? I'm not sure of the question. What it relates to. It's asking about Prabhupada. The practical thing we can take and apply within our preaching. I'm not sure. Does anybody know what Dustin means? Dustin's become a Buddhist. None of us can figure out what he means. What is a practical thing we can take and apply within our own preaching? I think he wants me to summarize the essence. Yeah, we always. One of the things that everyone else understood the question, but except me, because they were answering it. One of the important points is that when people join ISKCON, they join from reading Prabhupada's books. They get trained in reading Prabhupada's books and understanding him. People are suggesting that all new devotees should read the Prabhupada Lilamrita. Just understand Prabhupada. Understand his position, and that would have a tendency to counteract guru groupism, because everyone would understand that everything is connected with Prabhupada, and every guru is representing Prabhupada. And we had a class that Sureshwar and I gave in Johannesburg, and I put it up now, so it's on the website, about Prabhupada's mood, his flavor, his spicing. Because I really wanted to understand devotees, to understand the context in which Prabhupada was presenting Krishna consciousness and what he was emphasizing, what his flavor was. And if we stay within that mood, then we keep his flavor no matter what. Everybody keeps his flavor. And that's you can say the unity is the spicing. You know, this is the way Prabhupada cooked. And you can always tell that spicing. You know, it's like your mother's cooking. You always know. And then one day you eat and say, did someone else cook today? It doesn't taste the same. Right? So Prabhupada's spicing, we know that. And so if there's somebody's teaching something or there's something, and you say, that doesn't taste like Prabhupada's spicing. Did Prabhupada cook that? So you'll know. So we want everyone to know what is Prabhupada's spicing. So when some other spicing comes, we know that's not his. Right? Okay, we're going to go. It's late. We went over time as usual. And Guru Nishtha has put the link to that lecture. It's a great talk. Everyone listen to it. Sureshwar and I talking about Prabhupada's flavor, Prabhupada's mood, the context of Prabhupada's Krishna consciousness. Okay? Well, Saturday. And glories to Srila Prabhupada. Gauranga Nityananda, Gopremanandi, Hari Hari Bol.